88.3, Southern FM, news and information.
We are now welcoming you on Southern FM to 2 hours direct from Germany of the landing, well, the preparations to land a spacecraft on a comet. Yes, the spacecraft is called Rosetta. At the moment, it's about 538 million kilometres from the Sun and about 400 million kilometres from the Earth. And it's travelled 6.4 billion kilometres to get there. And over the time during March through to August, it closed in on the comet, gradually slowed its speed. And since August, it has been circling the comet, flying in rendezvous and then in close formation. It is now only hours away, in fact, 2 hours away, from separating from the lander, which is called Philae, from the main spacecraft, which is called Rosetta. And on this evening's The Space Show, we're going to take you hopefully up to that separation point. And the landing will occur at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning, which unfortunately we can't broadcast to you live. Now, the event is actually happening in Darmstadt, Germany right now. And so we're going to cross over to Darmstadt and hear what's going on.
Great news from the main control room. Flight Dynamics told us the maneuver performed very well. We're go for lander delivery. So we've also just sent the commands and they're on their way to the spacecraft. The spacecraft is now slewing to the separation altitude. So we have LOS. We've lost telemetry, which is fully nominal. And now we just have to wait for separation.
Fantastic news there from Sylvain Lodieu, the flight director at the main control room in the European Space Operations Centre. Fantastic. So we've got the final go. And I'm moving now to three gentlemen who I'm sure will be relieved that we've got thus far. I will hand over one of those microphones as well. I have here with me, right in the center, John Elwood, former project manager. Next to him, Gerhard Schwem, former project scientist. And right opposite of me, Matt Taylor, the actual project scientist, and of course, all of them of the Rosetta mission. Gerhard, I'd like to start with you because you've been working on this mission even longer than Paolo and Jean-Pierre Biebring for almost 30 years now. You've been the mission manager from 2004 to 2010. You probably are the best person to ask, how did all of this start?
Yeah, it started, as you said, basically 30 years ago when I was here working at ESOC, and one day we were traveling to Zurich with Professor Hugo Festig to a meeting where we would discuss the planetary cornerstone, and we had a small group, and the idea was already there that we wanted to have a mission to a comet to bring back a sample, which in the end didn't work. We got the mission as we have, and we said, you know, we can't bring a sample in the laboratory. Bring the laboratory to the comet, and we are there, and it works. So it's really a great day.
It was originally a mission that should have happened together with NASA.
Yes.
But it didn't in the end.
Unfortunately, it didn't. We had joined. We started as a collaboration. Unfortunately, NASA couldn't stay with the mission as a big partner to go to a comet to get a sample back. But NASA is still involved with four instruments. And ESA had to take the decision, can we do something like ambitious like this alone? Can we take the lead? And we made a proposal then to go to a comet rendezvous with asteroid flyby in the early 90s. And 93, our advisory committee thought it's a great mission, it's worthwhile to do, and we got the go-ahead for this Rosetta mission as it is today. And I think that they took a great, wise decision, and I think we showed that we could do it.
Yeah.
And, we had proven it, and I think it was a great time, and it's still a great time.
So there was never a moment where you regretted that ESA decided to take that risk alone?
There was never a moment I regretted it. There were moments where you were thinking about if it was the right decision. You put a lot of effort in your private life and then in your professional life, but you have to overcome this. This is part of the game in space science, and you know, hurdles are there to be taken. And I think in the beginning, the project manager with his team had to do a lot of on the technology side. For me, it was a task to get my dear science friend under control.
Which isn't always easy.
And that is also a big task. I think Matt has learned that. And Because they are very ambitious, they will always want to get more, and you have to see that you get the balance, what is technically possible, what is financially possible, and to do the best in the end. So it's a balance, and you fight a little bit against these guys from the technical side. And these are the moments, but this is great in the professional life. You have to work with these guys, and it's really rewarding.
John, you joined at some point in the late 90s. That was when the Rosetta project was already, in a way, up and running. Why? Why did you join then?
Yes. I joined about halfway through the main sort of production phase of the project. Rosetta is an amazingly complex spacecraft. And like most of these complex spacecraft, at that time it was going a bit later. The schedule was slipping. The difference between Rosetta, however, was that we had a fixed launch date. So when I came on, there were a lot of challenges we had to look at. We changed some of the organizations in industry and some of the personnel. We really reinforced a lot of the teams. We brought lots more engineers in. And we had to think about how we were going to get a spacecraft ready. And at this point, we still only had about 2.5 years to go, and we weren't really on schedule. We had a sort of prototype and engineering model, as we called it, being integrated in Germany. And the flight model being integrated in a different place. And we realized that we had to try and get the whole thing more efficient. So we moved the engineering model and the flight model to our base in Aztec in the Netherlands and brought all the engineers, this amazing international team, up to Noordwijk. I think at one time we had 5 shifts a day working. We had 3 shifts working on the main spacecraft and 2 on the prototype, testing out all the procedures. With this amazing team from all over Europe, and in particular from Germany and Italy, we got it moving anyway.
You got it ready, but then the launch didn't happen after all.
Yes, we did, actually. We had the spacecraft ready. What was it, about the middle of 2002? We went off to Kourou. We fueled the spacecraft. We're all ready to go before Christmas. And then we had this terrible setback. Just late December, Ariane 5 had a failure. Now, this wasn't exactly the same configuration that we were going to fly on with Rosetta. However, we had to obviously look at all the common bits, and eventually it was decided that we couldn't risk to fly another Ariane 5 until we knew exactly what was the problem. We had this very fixed launch window in January 2003, and so we missed it. So we had to abort the mission for that launch opportunity.
So apart from it being some kind of blow, but something that was not impossible to repair, it also meant that you actually missed the comet that was chosen originally, Virtanen.
Yes, we were all set to go on January the 23rd to Virtanen, and we had to think again. And immediately we thought of 2 things. First of all, Gerhardt and his team sort of tried to find another comet target. But in fact, there were still possibilities that if we could find another launch vehicle, we could actually go to Virtanen a bit later. And I spent quite a bit of time in Moscow talking to the Russians, and we'd actually negotiated a potential Proton launch, which we could do a few months later. The problem was that as we were ready to launch, we'd actually filled the spacecraft both with fuel and oxidizer in Kourou. And so we scratched our heads a bit and thought, can we empty it? Because obviously if we're going to transport these spacecraft around the world, it was something you don't do. And eventually we thought that there was the danger of cracks in the tanks if we'd emptied the tanks. So we eventually realized we couldn't do that. So we had to rely on finding a new comet target.
And we did eventually with 67P.
That's right.
Churyumov-Gerasimenko, the one that we hopefully land on later today. Now, John and Gerhard, both of you, even though you're very passionate about it, you can be a bit more relaxed because you're both retired already. The baton has been handed over to the next generation. Matt Taylor is today. So we said already, you were there right from the beginning, Gerhard, 30 years ago, Paula and Jean-Pierre Briebring, 20 years ago. So we're talking about a mission that is stretching over at least 3 decades. And now you came in last year, Matt. How do you cope with suddenly taking over something like this and running the show?
Well, I don't particularly run the show. I am part of the show. Sometimes people think I am the show. I think it's exemplified that we're all on stage here. So, the generations pass over information. A good example of that passage of time and also how the experience is put across the generations is here at ESOC, where you have Paolo, Andrea and Sylvain. So you've got these three generations of sons there that have all been on the mission. Me personally, I'm the new kid on the block. Andrea has 18 years. I've got 18 months. It's been a long 18 months. It feels like 18 years. I came on board the project having been working on the cluster mission. It's a fantastic mission, everyone. I came into ESA as a deputy project scientist on that mission and was guided by the project scientist there, Philip Escobar, and that's how I gained my experience, and I came on board Rosetta because of that experience. I had become project scientist of cluster, and I ticked the boxes and came to Rosetta. From a scientific point of view, experience is passed over with refereed journals, and so that's how you base your next step. So we also had with Giotto, that was targeting certain aspects of a comet, and already then we knew what Rosetta would be and what that had to do. And you have this timeline in science where the journals give you the indication, or the papers give you the indication of where we should be going, what questions we should be asking. And I hope, and the aim, at least my part of my job, is to ensure that we rewrite some of this.
Rewrite history books. Now, before we may elaborate a bit more on the actual job of a project scientist, I was just told that, Gerhard, we have a picture of you showing you as a young man, just in order to prove that the generation that sits here also was young as Matt once. Yeah, here we have you. I don't know, what is that? Is that the early 80s? Is that roughly about the right time?
That was actually the night of the Giotto Heli encounter. It was my birthday, 13th of March, 1986. I was 37 years old and I look young, and okay, there's hope for Matt that he will age.
That was before Photoshop.
Gracefully, and he will get his grey hair as well, but that was when I was young and active and could work through the day and night.
That was so before Rosetta? Yeah.
That was before, was not before, because we had the first meeting in 85. I did that in parallel. I was deputy project scientist. We had these ambitions already before we had the success with Giotto. You see, we were ambitious. We had the vision, not only me, but others, and we wanted to do it. So that was in the middle of it. It shows there's a long continuation, and you have to give that on to the next generation.
Exactly. Yeah. So we just have these moments in time here, but it's nice to be able to put it in a bigger context. So now, Matt, do tell us, because we already heard Gerhard sort of saying that sometimes it's quite a tough job to sort of to keep all the scientists in check and make sure that they're, you know, sort of coordinated. Spill some beans.
I wouldn't do such a thing. A project scientist, by definition, I am the chair of a science working team. The science working team is made up of all the principal investigators. They're the lead scientists of each of the instruments. On Rosetta, we also have and this is the orbiter instruments. On Rosetta, we have the lander lead scientists. We have Herman Bonhard, who's currently at LCC, and you've already met Jean-Pierre. They represent the lander in that group. We also have interdisciplinary scientists. These are what I refer to as comet ninjas. They're the guys that can span the science of different instruments to give us a broader perspective. So that is the representation of the science and the community, really, at the highest level. It's augmented by the wonderful Claudia Alexander, my NASA counterpart. She's the project scientist from the US side. So with that team, we try and push the science, the original proposals, the science master plan, this is what we proposed to do. So we try and ensure that we do the best job at doing that. Now, we have different instruments on board. They have different wants and different needs. We have to try and negotiate within the team. You were alluding to what my job is. It's to try and keep all of those members of the SWT happy or equally unhappy. I think that's really the job that's there. And this is supported by my colleagues down in ESAC who run the Science Ground segment. So I think yesterday we were talking to Larry O'Rourke. They're the guys that take the instrument commands from the PIs and put them into the system to massage everything and put everything through. So that's basically where we are in terms of science and project science. But at SWT level, there are times where, say, one instrument will want to look directly at the comet. So Giada, for instance, will want to detect dust coming off of the comet. And the same measurement can be made by the camera. So you measure the velocity by capturing the dust, or you can look perpendicular to the comet direction to watch the dust fly past you and measure it with the camera. So we have to have those kind of discussions to say, well, who goes first and when do we make this measurement? It's the same measurement but done in a different way with different instruments. So it's kind of that. You put in a mixing pot and you come out, and as long as most people are smiling, we should be okay.
Well, I'm sure you're strong enough to deal
on
with
the Southern FM. You're listening to a two-hour space show special from 6:05 to about 8:05 on the there have been preparations to land the Philae spacecraft on the comet 67P. We go back to Germany now. We're taking a live stream from Germany.
It's something special. You also have to imagine, and I take this, you know, it's Rosetta is in a rendezvous with the Cometarium of Gerasimenko. What happens today, you are there, and now is a big moment. Is there will be there the first kiss. Philae will land. It's like, you know, touching the comet, and this is great. It's always exciting, you know, it's with these teams. Whenever you have these missions, you have worked on this. With the team, it's an excitement, and you want to be there, and we are there, and I think you can't lose that feeling.
Yes, I mean, for me, this is an amazing mission. I mean, it is, to me, real exploration. You've heard all these scientific goals, and we've just been through this 10-year journey through space out to Jupiter, 2.5 years in hibernation. And before that, we had all the excitement of trying to get all this technology ready to launch. I mean, I can't think of a mission. I mean, it's really so dear to my heart. And today and the next year when we do this fantastic science, you know, hopefully it's going to be the climax to it.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Well, we all keep our fingers crossed. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Matt, John, Gerhard, thank you for taking the time. So now we heard a little bit more about how this mission came about. Let's jog our memory now and take a look at why ESA has decided to undertake this mission.
Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko comes from the Kuiper Belt, which is filled with millions of similar frozen remnants of our solar system. Collisions or gravitationally induced orbit changes can eject some of these dusty, icy space rocks into becoming comets, orbiting the Sun. We know from previous space missions that each comet has a frozen nucleus, often only a few kilometres across, and that when the comet's orbit approaches the Sun, it develops an atmosphere or coma. The solar wind pushes this atmosphere into trailing tails of dust, ions, and plasma that can stretch for thousands of kilometres. Water can be found in its tail, in the icy nucleus, and as a vapour in the coma. Studying comets will inform us about the formation of our solar system and shed light on the emergence of water and life on Earth, since scientists believe comets may have brought water and organic compounds to our planet. 5 years ago, glycine, one of just 22 amino acids in the human body and a chemical building block of life, was identified in a comet for the first time. Comet 67P's unusual shape is also of interest, since it may have been produced by two comets colliding and melding together. And it is by studying comets that we gain a greater scientific understanding of not just who we are, but where we come from.
Well, and I certainly know who this gentleman is right next to me, and I also know where he's from. He's from ESA's Technology Centre in Holland, Mark McCochrane. And Mark, I believe we have a lot of tweets already that we would like you to comment or maybe answer the questions that are posted through these tweets. We're just waiting for someone to bring them up so that we can actually see them. Oh, they're on the other side. That's very difficult for us. Here we are. Okay.
Just hoping they're not all from my daughter this morning.
Here we go. Wish I could stay up and watch. Hopefully my astro professor mentions it in class tomorrow. Good luck. Well, that's nice enough. Grumpy Short Pant. I like that name.
Okay.
What a time to be alive, sitting in the sun with a cuppa, getting ready to watch a robot land on a comet.
Well, that's evidently not somebody in Darmstadt.
not in England either, though the Kappa would refer to that. And Duminas, success to you, File 2014, and the team. Well, thank you very much. I'm pretty much looking forward to new knowledge regardless of the outcome. Well, that's hard. Lifts the heart, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that's where we are this morning, is that we know we have a huge challenge ahead of us during the day. But there's science already there. There'll be science next year. And this metaphor, overused metaphor, cherry on the cake, that's where we are this morning. I think it's a bit early for a rich cake, but maybe by late this afternoon, a cuppa and a piece of slice of cake with a cherry on top would be perfect.
Yeah, well, I'm ready. I'm certainly ready for a piece of cake now after this breakfast program. Now, we've been talking all the while about how we started the mission, and we also touched on the... obviously, the topic, why we do this mission. It's all the big questions Jean-Pierre Bibring was mentioning. Where do we come from? We might not get the answer to where we go. That would be the next step. But where do we come from? How do we get here? Do you personally think that 67P, Churyumov Gerasimenko, is capable of giving us those answers?
We've talked a lot about this comet being a treasure chest and that we're looking for the key. Well, in reality... this comet is actually a key to unlocking a much bigger treasure chest, which is the whole population of comets throughout the solar system. You know, one of the questions we ask ourselves is, did water come from comets? And did the complex molecules which make us up, you know, whether we're French or German or British, you know, maybe we're all made up from comet stuff. But of course, this comet never hit the Earth. So by definition, what we find here is not... the comet which brought the water to the Earth, but it could be a key to unlocking the various populations. There are a trillion comets out there today, still, and yet that's a very, very small fraction of the population was there shortly after the birth of the solar system, 4.6 billion years ago. So this one locks up some of the information that's left over, but this one will not solve all those questions, but that's how we do science. Mm. We advance step by step, we ask big, challenging questions, we go to crazy places to try and unlock those questions, but it always, always, fortunately for us, for job security, leads to a whole next range of questions. So you were talking about generations a few minutes ago. Matt's kids, my kids, they're the next generation who will take the knowledge we learn this year and then take that forward to a whole new set of questions. And that's what this is about as well. This is about inspiring the next generation of people to go on and ask those questions and many other questions in science.
And, I mean, you said we go to crazy places right now. We're some 500 million kilometres far, far away from our planet Earth. And we try to reach this place that we can see here. We've got a nice little model there. Actually, even this one that we see here, Philae the lander, in respect to the comet model, it's even smaller than that. It's just like the head of a pin, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a 4-kilometre object here. I mean, it's a very lumpy object, but roughly speaking, 4 kilometres in all directions. And Philae itself, or you see it on the other side of the stage, it's a metre and a half across. So if you scale that down, indeed, it just would almost not be visible on here. In one way, it would be, and that is that this comet is incredibly dark. Just doesn't reflect very much light at all. And Philae, even though it's got solar panels to gather light, is more reflective. So there is that chance that that little glint of light, if we see that on the surface, when we land on the surface, that will be the telltale. We might not resolve it and see the legs in it. We'll see a little glint, hopefully.
Okay. I know that we have one last tweet, hopefully, that we can hopefully comment when we see it. It's, here we are. So what does it say? First of all, Philae 2014, that's the right title. All is in order, so I'm go for separation from ESA Rosetta, just a few hours left.
Well,
so,
absolutely. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Mark McCaughran, thank you very much. And fingers crossed, we'll hopefully meet more often in the course of today, absolutely. This exciting day today. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is the moment where we will wrap this particular coverage. We witnessed the trajectory maneuver. We got the final go for separation, and that separation will take place in about 90 minutes from now. We'll be back to cover this again in our live coverage, of course, which will start at 9:30 Central European time. In the meantime, you can stay glued to the TV screens or also to the internet, because we will continuously show pictures right from the main control room here at the European Space Operations Center. So I look forward to seeing you again at 9:30. Until then, take care and don't forget, keep fingers crossed.
Well, we have been listening on the Space Show, a special edition of the Space Show, to a live event happening in Germany right this very moment. And we're leading up to the landing of the Philae spacecraft on the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko, otherwise known as 67P. The P stands for periodic, which means it comes back every few years. Now, we're going to continue our broadcast up until a little after 8 o'clock, when we expect to have the actual separation of Philae from the Rosetta spacecraft. After that, it'll be a 7-hour descent, and the spacecraft will land on the comet at about 3 o'clock our time. That's 3 o'clock tomorrow morning, Thursday morning. The landing time is a little uncertain because the trajectory is subject to a slightly unknown effect of gravity of the comet, and the comet is spinning, and it's quite a complex shape. So it's plus or minus about 20 minutes on that 3 o'clock landing. Now, we're going to play some community announcements here, and then we're going to come back with what happened in the half hour before we went on air. So, and we'll have a bit of music as well. This is the Space Show.
Trees and taste like candy canes. Mmm. And I love hearing the jingle bells and Santa's ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho!
I really wish I knew what it looked like, though.
Donate to Vision Australia's Light a Candle Christmas Appeal and you'll help light up Christmas for kids who are blind or have low vision. Go to lightacandle.net.au to donate today.
This is going to be the best Christmas ever.
Donate now at lightacandle.net.au.
Hi, you've reached Frank from the Heavy Decibels program. I'm not here right at the moment, but if you love screaming guitar, pounding drums, then maybe you should join me every fortnight, Saturdays 10 p.m. till midnight, where I'll play some of the latest releases in international and local bands. Otherwise, you're welcome to leave a backwards message and I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
You're tuned to the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, we are broadcasting the lead-up to the separation of the Philae lander from the Rosetta spacecraft. Rosetta and Philae are currently in orbit around the comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, and they are at the moment, they've just given a few minutes ago the go for landing, and that means that they're now set up. There's one final go or no go just before they separate, and there's about a 25-minute light travel time from the spacecraft. So that separation will actually occur during the normal part of the space show, and a little after 7:30 this evening. And then the receipt of that signal will come just a smidge after 8 o'clock tonight, all going well. And the landing is going to be at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning, Australian Eastern Daylight Time. Now, we are going to play a little bit of music here. And this is a song written to wake up Rosetta after it was in hibernation for about 2 years. And this is written by Ted Robeson and Big Mama D.
Wake up, Rosetta. Wanna push your button to open your eyes. You've been sleeping too long, Rosetta, Rosetta. We need to know what's going on, Rosetta, Rosetta. People are waiting for you, Rosetta. Wake show up, your data now,
Rosetta.
Show your data now.
Open your eyes.
Look at here.
Wake up, Rosetta.
Wake on up.
Wanna push your button to open your eyes.
Scientists are getting worried. Smith.
What's happening?
Rosanna. Rosanna.
What's going on, girl?
You've got some work to do.
A lot of work.
Come here, girl. You cost a lot of money.
Yes, you did.
Now come on, open your eyes. And don't you know you gotta wake up.
Wake up, Rosanna.
Wake up, Rosanna.
Open your eyes. Wake up, Rosanna.
Rosanna.
Wanna push your button. Open your eyes.
Come on and tell
us. Wake up, Rosanna.
Tell us what's
what
going on.
On Southern FM, The Space Show, that was Wake Up Rosetta by Ted Robeson and Big Mama D, one of a number of songs that was written for the Rosetta spacecraft. And last week on the show we had some poetry, and we've tried to see if we can sneak in a bit more of that poetry on this week's show. But now we're going to wind the clock back about an hour to the first part of this event at the European Space Operations Centre in Darmstadt, Germany. And here is how they were calling the decision to go for the landing or not go for it.
At the moment, I know you're busy, but you'll be back with us later, all right? Thank you, Paolo. Well, let's take a moment now. I'm going to join some gentlemen who have already taken a seat, and I bring you a second microphone. Stefan, you've already got one, so and these gentlemen here, I would like to talk with them about science and technology. Stefan Ulametz, we already met you just now, Philae Lander Manager at the DLR. There is Professor Jean-Pierre Biebring, Philae Lead Scientist and Shiva Principal Investigator at the Université Paris Sud. And then in the middle, we have Wolfgang Pitz, Head of European Earth Observation, Navigation and Science Program at Airbus Defence and Space. Welcome, gentlemen, on this exciting morning in space science. Stefan, you already told us a bit about those crucial minutes during the night. And, of course, you are extremely close to this lander. You know every screw of it. What is the most critical point now?
Well, I think the most critical point was and still is the landing itself, the touchdown on the surface. This is where all the uncertainties of the cometary surface come into play. This is where we also need some portion of luck not to hit a boulder, not to happen to touch down at one of these cliffs. Mm. So this is and was, and we always consider this as the really critical moment, the touchdown itself.
Yeah. Which still is a few hours away from now, so we mustn't stop crossing our fingers, of course, all the time. Wolfgang, the lander is about 1.5 kilograms heavy, and it's on the back of a huge satellite. And this lander has traveled, obviously, as I mentioned, for 10 years. Do you think that the mechanics are still up to date, are still capable of dealing with everything that's happening now?
Well, first of all, it's about 100 kilograms.
100?
Not 1.5. So
100? That's heavy.
Yes. Well, the orbiter has brought Philae, the lander, all the way safely to where it can now deploy its landing gear. And actually, we had to develop quite a number of new technical concepts and technologies to make this happen. So, for instance, a very highly efficient new solar cell type, failure-tolerant star trackers and new heat louvers to keep the heat inside the spacecraft, and also a concept to save power, hibernation. And all this worked perfectly, so we're very proud of this, of course. And the mechanisms, we have tested them many, many times, so yes, I'm very confident this is going to work.
Brilliant, because this the whole mission was deemed as something impossible, mission impossible, until one came up with the idea of hibernation. That was very important, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So Rosetta had to do a swing deep into the outer parts of our solar system. And at the point furthest away from the sun, we receive only about 3% of the solar energy which we receive down here on Earth. So we had to develop a concept to save power, and we came to hibernation. And actually, it's even more like a controlled coma. So only the very, very basic routines inside the onboard computer are still running while the rest of the spacecraft is fully shut down. And, well, it worked perfectly. And
because a lot
never been done before.
Exactly, and of course, a lot of people are involved in the hardware of the spacecraft. How many do you have a figure?
Oh yes, Airbus Defence and Space, as a prime contractor, was leading a consortium of about 96 companies in 16 countries. So, at peak times, we had more than 1,000 people working on Rosetta, and they all gave their best to make this happen today. And they are all very proud if this is going to work today.
And all very nervous and excited today. Wolfgang,
absolutely.
If you could just pass on the microphone to Jean-Pierre. Jean-Pierre, I know that you brought a selfie, but before we talk about not your selfie, but a very, very special selfie, which we will see in a minute, let me just ask you first, you've been a lead scientist of the Lander Consortium for 20 years. And so, like Paolo, I should think you must be thrilled by the sheer fact that we've come thus far already. You told me earlier that you're feeling fine, so you're not too nervous then?
Well, you know, no one would believe if I said that we are not anxious, of course. I mean, imagine, to land on a comet is not trivial, right? So we are there, and more than that, we are there to decipher the clues of our origin. So it's really amazing. The ambition is very high, so of course we are very anxious. But we are more excited than anxious, because we are convinced that we did the best for that to work. So it's going to be a success. I mean, no other way, of course. The important thing, I think, is that, you know, it's a highly cooperative venture. We have 10 instruments on board working, so tens of institutions there, working with a lot of different systems, and we really work in a highly partnership. So what we did over the years was try to optimize each individual instrument. But more than that, because we are very constrained in resources, we have very few energy in particular, we've gone to optimize the sequence of that. So all what we did is try to have the optimized sequence to ensure that all instruments will work in sequence, but that we will fit within the constraint we have. We cannot miss 1 second of operation, and that was really very tough, and we did that. So we are optimists more than that.
You've done all the homework, all you could, and you are also the principal investigator of one of the instruments, of course, of the lander. I mentioned it earlier, the Shiva panoramic camera system. And Shiva has already sent us a selfie.
This is true. Shiva is actually two set of things. First, we'll make with 7 cameras the panorama where we land in stereoscopic way. So normally by the end of the day, we should see that. So that the very last image that we could do with the orbiter first and then the comet, in a few hours, we'll have the comet itself. Actually, we have also the orbiter itself, because sometime today we'll make a picture of the orbiter. We'll just leave it, the farewell pictures, and then we'll go there. And the idea is really to contribute with all the other instruments to decipher really the clues of our origin. What are the processes involved there? What are the ingredients there? Shiva is just one of the possibility to try to get that information by imaging, also by microscopic imaging, because there are possibilities to see the sample themselves and measuring the composition. Mm-hmm. And through the composition, we hope to understand whether or not the system we are in now could find the different diverse pathways that make the Earth as it is now different from Mars Eve. That's the key question. Why are we here? Why is the Earth different from the others? How life started? That's really the sort of thing that we are trying to decipher in this comet now.
But isn't it amazing? Because obviously this is the key question. Where do we come from? Why are we here? And why do we hope that some black, icy rock somewhere in space would give us these answers?
Well, you know, when you observe the solar system now, actually, we do not understand why life started here and not other ways. And we are convinced that really the keys were in the origin of the system itself, the process that really governed the modeling of the different pathways. And the comets have this beauty of having preserved the composition of the ingredients out of which all the solar system formed. In particular, we know that comets are made of ice, so they should be very bright. They are darker than that. Why? Because most of the carbon is in form of complex molecules that were formed prior for the planet themselves to form, probably a high level of complexity. And we are essentially convinced that these molecules, with a specific composition and structures, when they were fed in the oceans of the Earth and possibly of other planets, were the missing link to the emergence of life. And so one of the questions is, okay, what are these constituents? And second, are these constituents and this process specific to our solar system, or are they generic in the universe? In other words, these should tell us some clues whether or not we are alone in the universe, finally. Mm. So it's really very ambitious.
Very ambitious indeed, Jean-Pierre Bibering. Thank you. Last question, which I have to ask Stéphane, because I know that you have to head back to the main control room. It's a very busy day. What's your job? What's happening next?
As Paolo has said, there is still the one go, no go decision from Flight Dynamics. After that, we will initiate and start some more of the instruments on the lander, those which will be operating already during descent. Then we have the separation itself, which will be very exciting, because then, the lander is alone, so to say, and has to find its way gravity-driven to the surface. It will be stabilized within a flywheel and descend for about 7 hours to the surface. Now, at touchdown, then, we will fire the harpoons. We have planned to also activate the cold gas system I mentioned before. Yeah. We have some problems there. This will make the landing even more challenging now, because we cannot operate this pressure on the surface to avoid the rebouncing.
Yeah.
We have to fully rely now on the harpoons. But after touchdown, immediately the first scientific sequence will start, and each of the instruments should be operated within the next couple of days, about 2.5 days at least once.
That's all amazing. Let's hope that the comet embrace helps it a bit. Stéphane?
We're live to air on the space show. It's a special from 6 o'clock until 8 o'clock, and we are covering the separation of the Philae lander from the Rosetta spacecraft, both of which are in orbit around the comet at the moment, Comet 67P. We recorded an hour ago the events that happened at the Flight Center before. After 6 o'clock, we broadcast live the event, and now we just sort of retract a little bit, wound back the clock, as it were. So let's go back to this event that was happening at Darmstadt in Germany. This is the Space Show, 88.3 Southern FM.
Unamets, Wolfgang Pitz, Jean-Pierre Bibering, thank you very much. Stefan, I'll just take your microphone already. Thank you. Now, I mentioned that this is, of course, a major, major effort, not just by the European Space Agency on its own, but there are many other operation centers. And we'll cross over now to one, namely the Lander Control Center in Cologne in Germany. And we see that this is also, it looks quite relaxed at the moment, not too many people in there right now. But we hope we'll be able to speak in just a second with Barbara Cozzoni. She's the thermal and system engineer for Philae. And there she is. Barbara, good morning. Thanks for sneaking out of the control desk for us. And you are working the night shift, I hear. Tell us what's going on behind you right now, because right now they all look relaxed.
Yes, finally, we are a bit more relaxed than at the very beginning when I started my shift. It was 1 o'clock when we were still very busy checking the status of all the lander subsystem to give our go. So we managed at the end to give the go. We are confident that we'll succeed in the landing. At the moment, it's true that we are a bit relaxed. We are not so many people in the control room. All the people who worked in the past, in the previous hours, now they are resting to face all what we have to do after touchdown. Nevertheless, this doesn't mean that the lander is not doing anything at the moment. We are here because the lander is operating already. We switch on our first instrument, ROMAP. Since a couple of hours, is already collecting data on the magnetic field of the comet, and soon, in something like half an hour, we have to switch on other instruments like MUPUS and SESAME, instruments to characterize the properties of the cometary surface and subsurface. We also have to switch on our cameras, Chiva, to take the farewell images, so we will take a goodbye picture of Rosetta just after the separation. And also we have to switch on the other camera we have, Rollis, which will take picture of this surface when we approach just before the touchdown. So all these instruments have already to be on before separation because they have to prepare themselves for the operation already during descent. Some of them will collect data and will operate calibration. They have to prepare all their sensors. So let's say that we are not so many in the control room, but we are busy.
You are busy and you're already doing science as we're here. Now, you're a physicist and an expert in thermal behavior of the lander. Thermal behavior, why is that an issue?
Thermal behavior is very critical in space. Right now, something we are doing indeed is to perform an additional heating of our primary battery. Let's say that all the instrumentation in space and the system to operate, to have the good performance from this instrument, they have to operate inside the a specific thermal range, not too cold, not too warm. Unfortunately, from this point of view, space is not a friendly environment. You face very cold condition, and if you approach to the sun, you can face very hot condition. This is also for the lander. We are monitoring the lander to keep the temperature in the good range, actually to have it at the best level in order to optimize the performance, especially for our primary battery. We are now performing an additional heating in order to have the temperature of the primary battery high enough to optimize its performance and to get as much possible energy from the primary battery, because we have a very ambitious program on the comet. We want to operate for hours, for 67 hours. The battery has to has to be in a good shape and has to give very good performance. That's why the heating is very important. But obviously the battery itself, the two batteries, because we have two, they will not be enough to perform all the operation we want to do. We rely also on the solar power that our solar panels will collect during the operation.
Okay, Barbara, because I understand that the battery only has a limited life power, and so it is crucial that everything works like clockwork when we get there. Barbara Cozzoni at the LCC in Cologne, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay. And let's move to another important player who has joined forces in order to make the Rosetta mission possible. And that is the Space Operations Navigation Center Song in Toulouse in southern France. And there we already take a look at their room, which is the main control room there, I believe. And outside of it, or inside of it right now, is Jean-Bernard Dubois. He's the head of Space Exploration Missions Operations. Jean-Bernard, just correct me if I'm wrong. Are you inside or outside the main control room? Because it also looks very quiet there too.
Yes, Monica, I'm inside the main control room of the Science Operation and Navigation Center here in CNES Toulouse. This is a place where 20 people are working 24 hours a day, and now what you can see is the beginning of the morning shift. In fact, we are in relationship with a lot of countries through Europe, and there are lots of scientists and engineers working with us. But this place is devoted entirely to PhilAE, and it is the place from which every information coming from the instruments of PhilAE are planned and tracked during this day. And what you can see here is what we call the science management team. This science management team is in charge of tracking this data and replanning everything if things are not exactly like it was planned at the beginning. So after separation, these teams will have a lot of work to do, of course, and that's why we'll have a lot of decision to be taken from the information given by the data sent by the lander. And it will be the first big moment of this day, the separation.
Exactly. You will receive the data of all 10 instruments, of course. What are you going to do with all that data when it comes down?
Yes, we will receive a lot of data from the 10 instruments, and this data, we use them, we collect the raw data, and we have algorithms and software to process this data. There is a special team for this, which is called the data processing team, and this team here is in charge of looking at this data and sorting them, displaying them on screens, as you can see, and, of course, pulling them back to the scientists as soon as possible.
Okay.
And for an example, what you can see on the screen in the room here is one example of a map of the comet, which has been designed by this team during the summer and used intensively to produce the selection of the site, which will be today our aim.
All right.
And today, the next event, certainly for this team, will be the moment when we will receive the Shiva camera, the Shiva image from the Shiva camera, which will be taken by Philae, and which will be the image from the orbiter, from the Philae lander.
Okay.
It will be evidently a very high moment, a big moment for us,
and we really look forward to that one, of course. Jean-Bernard Dubois Esson, thank you very much. We have to leave it here at this moment, but best of luck, and we look forward to those images that you will share with us later.
On the Space Show, a special two-hour edition of the Space Show, we are taking the feed from the European Space Operations Centre in Darmstadt, Germany. We recorded that between 5:40 and 6 o'clock. We're going to be crossing over to Darmstadt again to take more of the action that's happening there. But first, let's catch up on a briefing that happened on Friday last week, at which they gave the status of the spacecraft at that time.
Here in Darmstadt to what I believe is being Space Operations Center here in Darmstadt to what I believe is one of the most exciting weeks, at least in my life, and I guess in your life as well. And this is the briefing landing minus 2 days, and therefore, we want to give you an update of the current status of the Rosetta mission. And we've been inviting Andrea Accomazzo, he's the flight director, Sylvain Lodiot, he's the spacecraft operations manager, and there is also Matt Taylor, the project scientist of Rosetta, and the Philae lander manager from DLR, Stefan Ulamech.
Thanks, Markus, and welcome again to everybody. I don't deny that we are a bit tired, but we are also very excited. I think this is the key week of our professional career. I don't think we will land on a comet another time, so I hope it's the right one. We've been working very, very heavily in the past months. We are convinced we've done all what we had to do and all what we could do for this operation. I think we've done it very professionally, at least this is my judgment. Maybe I shouldn't be the one judging this, but we've put all the effort we could into this activity. There's still a lot in front of us. There are many things that depend on what we are going to do in the next couple of days. There are a couple of things that do not depend at all on what we are going to do. For example, when we touch down, we cannot select a single spot when we touch down. Then we need to be a bit lucky. But we know we've done all what we had to do. We've done our best to prepare for this, and I'm convinced of this.